Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 32. This is your brain on God. Reclaiming Christianity is sponsored by our patrons. Check us out at patreon.com/John Weldy. Hello again, friends, and welcome to Reclaiming Christianity, the only Christian podcast where we expect our audience to understand references from 80s public service announcements. I'm John Weldy, and I'm just a guy. I am no one of consequence. I would love to not just be talking here at you. I would love to be talking with you. You can talk back at reclaimingchristianity.net. We've got a book club you can join, a discussion club. You could even be on this podcast. Just check it out at reclaimingchristianity.net or send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. So this episode is going to be really cool. We're in our second episode about Mike McHarg's book, Finding God in the Waves, and we're going to talk about brain science. And this is really kind of the crux of the matter to me on this book. This was the most interesting stuff to me in this book, and really my only takeaway the first time that I read it. Not saying it's a bad book or anything, but my really huge takeaway that I've gone into with several different people, several different groups, is going to be the reading, the main reading that we read in this episode. So I'm really excited to get into that with a couple guys here. First, a couple things about our schedule coming up. Our next episode is going to be our last one on Finding God in the Waves. It's going to be about deconstructing and community. It's very, very common for while you're in this deconstructing space, trying to figure out what it is that you believe, that you're not accepted in your community anymore, the community you had before, or even your family, or sometimes you're even ostracized from them. And it's really important to still be able to connect in some way and find that community. So we'll be talking about that in our next episode. And then after that, the episode beyond that is the first in a series that we're going to do. It's going to be a 6-month series, one podcast per month, that we're going to go through the entire New Testament. It's called Evolution of the Word, and it's based on a Marcus Borg book where he puts the entire New Testament together in chronological order, and not chronological as far as when things happened, but chronological as far as when they were written, which is going to give a really interesting arc of how the New Testament, even though it was only written over the course of somewhere between 30 and 100 years, even though it's written in that short of a time frame, there still is a lot of change that goes on in those books. And it's going to be really interesting to go into that. And I would love for you to join us, join in with that. And after that episode, we're going to launch into the April book, which is The Bible Tells Me So by Pete Enns. So in this episode, I've got a couple fellas here that have read Mike's book, Finding God in the Waves. They're both science/faith-minded type people, and they're both very interesting people that I think you get a lot out of. The first one is Thad Cruz. Thad, welcome to the podcast. Welcome back.
Thank you, John. Good to be back.
Yeah, so you were on a podcast a couple months ago where we had a few different atheists on here. So why were you on that podcast?
Well, my left brain is an atheist.
Okay. And we will get into that pretty fully here later on.
You'll exactly. That'll make sense. That will make sense in a minute.
Thad, what's one book that you would recommend to our audience?
Steven Pinkert's new book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism and Progress.
I'm so jealous that you've read that. Tell me a little bit about. See, I love The Better Angels of Our Nature. That's a fantastic. Even though it's extraordinarily dense, it's a very long book.
Yes, and this one's even longer. But it's just got a ton of data where he basically says now is the best time in human history to be alive, and there's no contest. And he's giving the data from a variety of things: health, war, death for, you know, something falling, hit me on the head, whatever the data is now is the best time. Of course, it doesn't mean what people have to understand is it doesn't mean that for everybody alive now is the perfect time to be alive.
Right.
Basically, it sucked to be alive worse 50 years ago, 500 years ago, 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that we don't get, you know, especially, well, I'm not going to get into all that, but that's a whole other episode that we could talk about. That fatalism that we get from conservative Christianity, evangelical Christianity, about the world's going to hell and Jesus needs to come back and save us.
Yes, this is a good book to counteract that mentality.
To refute that. Awesome. Awesome. And that's how I got into Better Angels of Our Nature, actually, was refuting that argument. So thank you very much, Thad. The second person that we have on here, the second panelist, is Jason Armold. And Jason, you're a preacher.
I am.
Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I have originally started in what would probably be considered a fundamentalist background, and now I preach at a United Methodist church, so I've kind of gone Protestant mainline, Bible college, seminary, whole nine yards, but I used to work in science. I used to work in a sleep medicine lab, so I've got a left brain that loves science, and I've got a right brain that loves theology, so...
Nice.
I resonate a lot with what's going on in Mike's book.
So United Methodist Church is kind of all over the map a little bit. I mean, they're more on the main line, you know, but there could be some pretty conservative United Methodist congregations also. How have you walked that tightrope?
Well, in our congregation, we consider ourselves purple. We're not conservative. We're not liberal. We've got people from all spectrums, and I'm right in the middle, theologically, socially, so I seem to be able to walk it. But I've seen a lot of people in various churches that haven't done so well. You're right. There's right now we're having a long discussion over homosexual marriage in the Methodist Church, and that'll be resolved somewhere around 2020. And it may lead to a split within the church. We're not sure yet.
On a major level, wow, yeah, that'd be really interesting. So you say that you're in the middle of United Methodism. So, in other words, to all the evangelicals, you're a heretic.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Jason, what's one book that you would recommend to our audience?
Well, absolutely. Based on the subject we're reading tonight, it would absolutely be Andrew Newberg and Mark Waldman's book, "How God Changes Your Brain."
Yeah, that's one that Mike mentions in his book. And you said you've been reading that a little bit. Tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, one of the things that they do very well is from the beginning, explain how your neuroanatomy is connected to your perception of God. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the most helpful things for me to figure out this body versus mind kind of concept. And just like you said, your Hindu friend could not separate one from the other, I think the neuroscience really backs that up, that we're whole-bodied experiential creatures, and how we process our thoughts about God is quite unique, really. Yeah. It touches on all areas of the brain, both higher thought, lower thought, reptilian, cortex, neocortex, the most recently evolved parts of our brain, and just how it's all interlinked, and it's a lot messier than people want to give it credit for.
Yeah. Well, good. It's good to have you here, Jason. So
thank you.
The first thing I'd really want to do is I want to get into our book review, you know, because this is a book review podcast and we're going to be reading. We've got actually two readings from the book that we're going to do on two actually completely different topics, but they're both about the brain. And I think they're both really essential. So I want to have time to get to both of them. Now I gave my book, my review of the book last week. So I'd love to hear what you guys think about this book.
I love it. It's fantastic. His story resonates certainly with me. I think probably with Jason also, and with you and with a lot of people listening to this podcast that have a scientific mindset, but have experiences in our life that, we value those too, and we want to figure out a way to balance objective thinking with experiences that are meaningful to us. And I think Mike's book does a great job of that.
Absolutely. And I would go one further that my particular life experiences, particularly earlier life experiences, match and track quite closely with Mike's. Mike describes his early life experiences being bullied and then family trauma. And I didn't have parents who separated like he did, but I lost a brother when I was young. And to have that sense of loss at such an early age, and when you're still formulating thoughts that go to contribute to your general worldview, I really resonated with a lot of the early part of Mike's book, which recounts his personal story.
Yeah.
So, I thought this was one of the most honest books that I've read in quite some time.
Yeah, I agree. I resonated with the later part of his story when he was at Rob Bell's place. I went to the same event, not the same weekend, But the same event that he was at, where he had that small group discussion out there in California, actually flew out from Kentucky to California to attend one of those.
And so you're talking about this creative group. It's like a small group experiences. Like, how many people did they have at this thing along with Rob?
I think there were about 50 of us. It was the very first ones that he was doing. He ended up growing it to larger numbers, but those first ones he had were about 50 people.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, the whole thing that he's describing right there on the beach, the surfing, the communion was so powerful. And it, from my experience too. And then when I'm reading Mike telling his story, and it's not part of our reading today, but I hope everybody gets the book and reads it. Science Mike's story about the communion part of his time with Rob Bell. Mm-hmm. I mean, it struck me almost not to the same degree, but very, very close.
Because you have that experience.
Because it's, and then communion's all about the experience, and you listen to people tell their stories. Communion is very high on the list of moving experiences that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So give the book a rating. How many brain stems does it get?
It gets 110% on the brain stem scale. Which is my left brain, which is my right brain trying to exert itself a little bit there.
But yeah. Jason, how many brain stems?
Oh, it gets a 5 out of 5 brain stems for me, that's for sure.
Oh, and the correct answer is 3.14159 brain stems.
That's right. So close. At least there's a right answer.
All righty. So the first thing that I want to do, just kind of as an introduction to this, I've got a 2-paragraph portion of the book here that kind of gives Mike's idea about how he sees the brain and how he sees spirituality baked into it. So before we get into our real readings, I want to give just this little bit and then let you guys comment about it. So he says, and this is from page 111 of the book, "We can't find you and your elbow for a reason. Your body is the support system for your brain, and your brain is where you are. You can lose your arms and still be you. Your eyes can fail. You can get a new heart, but your brain is the part of you that is uniquely you. The pattern of neurons, synapses, and dendrites in your skull is demonstrably where your thoughts, feelings, and actions originate. Muck around with the gray matter, and you can change a person. If some external immaterial spirit is the real us, then why is it that our brains drive everything that we do? We may not understand consciousness precisely, but observation makes it clear where it and we come from, the brain." So what do you think about it? I mean, it's almost like he's saying, forget about this soul idea. You know, it's the brain, the brain, the brain, the brain, the brain.
Yeah, soul's a very poetic word that means different things to different people. We can't describe it scientifically, but experience is the word that I'll use most often when talking with people. And the brain is the heart, the source, the collection of memories of our experiences. So when we talk about our soul, we're really talking about, at least in this life, we don't know what happens for sure after we die. In this life, we're talking about our experiences. We need our brains to have those experiences, but our experiences are not our brains. There's a delicate dance between those two. And to appreciate that, I think is a good source of personal growth.
Absolutely. And I would even step it just a little bit beyond the brain. And there are points in which he touched on this in the book, Mike did. But there are other loci of perception in the body, particularly the gut, that can be sometimes functioning almost independently of the brain. So I would say it's not just the brain, but the nervous system itself that contains you. So yes, you can cut off an arm, a leg, but you lose a little bit of your wholeness when you do that. So I'd push back against Mike just a little bit there, maybe to clarify, but I tend to resonate with that. And I'd love to hear Thad talk a little bit more about the experience or perception, because that reminds me of some philosophy that came out of the 18th century, Bentham and some others in the European school that would talk about sense perception.
Yeah, I haven't read them. I'm not sure on their what they would say about it, but experiences are the language of the humanities. They're the languages of the arts. They're the language of poetry. Miley Cyrus says, I came in like a wrecking ball. She's talking about an experience, and she's using experiential poetic language, and we shouldn't apply scientific rigor to experiential communication.
Right.
Yeah, you definitely can't blame Miley Cyrus for being scientific.
No, not at all. Not at all. But she's doing a great job of expressing a very human experience that we all have of love and loss and the feelings that come along with that.
And wearing almost no clothes while riding a wrecking ball. I mean, who of us has not done that?
Just not in public on national television.
Oh, man. Yeah, nobody wants to see me do that. All right. So let's dig into our first excerpt from the book. And this is going to be starting on page 129 if you have the book. And this is the part that really, really hit me. I mean, if there were, this is not my favorite book. I think it's a good book. It's not my favorite book, but this part like really haunted me. And I wanted to make sure that we read this and we talk through it some. And I've actually gone through this part of the book with several different groups, you know, of different, even very conservative Christians, you know, to just say, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? You know, and it's an extremely thought-provoking section, if nothing else. So, your brain is divided into two hemispheres, left and right. The two halves of your brain, oh, and guys, interrupt me at any time you want to. The two halves of your brain communicate via a thick channel of nerves called the corpus callosum. In men, the two halves of the brain don't talk to each other too often. They essentially exchange emails when absolutely necessary. Hey, pick up the toothbrush. We have to brush our teeth. This relative silence is one of the reasons men can focus so well. If my children are quiet in another room, they cease to exist in my mind. Women, on the other hand, have much higher activity among their corpus callosum. The two halves of women's brains are in constant communication, and this allows my wife to be aware of everything, everywhere, all the time. Her consciousness creates and sustains a far more detailed map of our home than mine does. Have you ever heard what happens when a microphone gets too close to a loudspeaker? There's an awful high-pitched squeal called feedback. It's what happens when a sound system hears itself. I get that every time that I do a mic check. Feedback is self-amplifying and self-sustaining. In the 1960s, scientists learned that epileptic seizures are a form of feedback. Feedback on the corpus callosum between the two hemispheres of the brain. 1960s, this was 20 years ago, 30 years, or I'm sorry, 50, 60 years ago. Yeah, see, yes. I'm not using my corpus callosum right now. This was 56 years ago, not very long at all. So epileptic seizures are a form of feedback, feedback on the corpus callosum between the two hemispheres of the brain. In the most severe cases, epileptic seizures can be life-threatening. Neurosurgeons once decided to try a radical procedure to treat these patients. They surgically severed the patient's corpus callosum. No one knew what to expect when the first patient awoke after surgery. Surprisingly, the patient seemed unaffected and recovered fully. This was the case in multiple surgeries. Patients, this is really scary, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, okay, so I know this has something to do with it. Well, let's just cut it and see what happens. Oh
my God. The history of medicine. Yes. Well,
if you look up the history of frontal lobe lobotomies, and it's very similar, except the results were even more spectacular than this one.
Yeah. Oh, man, I just watched the movie Sucker Punch for the first time, and that's thinking of lobotomies. It's got a lobotomy in there. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I love the movie. And I know a lot of people hate the movie, but I don't care. Jennifer, I'm sorry. That's a total inside joke that doesn't mean anything. No one knew what to expect when the first patient awoke after surgery. Surprisingly, the patient seemed unaffected and recovered fully. This was the case in multiple surgeries. Patients were cured of epilepsy, but otherwise remained unaffected, or so doctors thought, until one of the patients punched his wife. The guy didn't mean to hit her. He was trying to give his wife a hug, but when his right arm reached out for an embrace, his left arm threw a punch. Another patient was picking out a dress for work, some sensible pattern, when her left arm grabbed a much louder print off the hanger and chose it over the dress in her right hand. A third patient couldn't sleep. He was terrified that his now unpredictable left hand would strangle him unless he stayed awake all night. Imagine that. It's like cousin It from, or no, what's Thing? Thing from Thing. The Addams Family, yes. Right?
Yes.
The hand that just moves around by itself.
brings new meaning to Jesus's command, if your right hand offends you, cut it off.
Exactly. Yes.
Wow. This strange, unsettling phenomenon is called alien hand syndrome, or AHS. And it's unique. Oh, it's AHS. We've got something for it. And it's unique to patients who've undergone this particular surgical procedure. Something happens when the two hemispheres of the brain can't communicate directly. Scientists weren't sure what it was, but they had some ideas. The two halves of your brain are basically identical. If you really have to, you can survive with only half of your brain. I mean, I know a lot of people that operate like that. Not seriously. But there are some differences between the two halves. For example, in most people, only the left half of your brain can initiate speech. The right half is mute. Not only are the hemispheres of the brain subtly different, they're also wired to the rest of the body backward. Your left hemisphere controls the right side of your body and vice versa. So when patients with AHS had a misbehaving left hand, this told scientists that something was going on in the right hemisphere of the brain. The prefrontal cortex is the brain's decision maker. Scientists believe it's where all the competing loops and systems of the brain converge, creating the experience we call consciousness. See, and here he says that this is an important point. Scientists believe that's where this happens. This is stuff we don't know still. This is stuff we're still working on and learning about.
I think that's something we really need to emphasize, that it's not that it's 100% conjecture. But science operates on the idea that the preponderance of the evidence is pointing in this direction, but we're still open to further clarification. And where we are at now is this seems to be the scientific consensus, but we're still in the infancy stages of understanding something as complex as the brain, trillions of cells that are operating in billions of ways. That when you talk about the neuron cells that are firing and they create new pathways and connections and they fire from one to another to create these circuits that are constantly changing, and we think we can figure it out in a few years. That's kind of hubris.
Well, it's 60 years ago. We didn't know what the corpus callosum did.
That's true. You
know, we had no idea. And 60 years in human development is the blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important also to note that science also says, a very important part of science also says, that if we find out evidence later on, we're going to change our mind.
Right.
We will change.
Yeah, people say that like it's a weakness of science. It's actually one of the strengths of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I heard it said the scientific revolution was a revolution in ignorance. For the first time in history, we said, I don't know. Let's find out.
Right. Yeah. And just like you said, this quote here, we believe, you know, they think that the science, the left brain thinking, scientific thinking, uses the word no with caution and based on a lot of evidence.
Yeah.
And it's the right brain. Thankfully, we don't have to have that same high bar for knowledge when we talk about, hey, I know that I'm hungry for, you know, pizza tonight, or I know that I love you as my spouse. And
I know that I've got a fever for the flavor of a Pringle.
Exactly.
All right, back to the text. Generally, the left prefrontal cortex is the dominant one. So by some definitions, the you think of as you is in your left prefrontal cortex. Your consciousness, now that's important, remember that. Mm-hmm. You also have a right prefrontal cortex. But your consciousness, they believe, lives in your left prefrontal cortex. Your consciousness may be associated with your left prefrontal cortex, but you also have a right prefrontal cortex. Almost every structure in your left brain is mirrored by one on the right. Scientists hypothesize that perhaps without the corpus callosum, the left prefrontal cortex lost its influence over the right. Perhaps alien hand syndrome happened because the two hemispheres of the brain began to drift. Doctors even began to wonder if each of us carries around a fully conscious right brain that serves as a mute slave to the left. That's a scary thought. There's another person in my head that can't talk.
It certainly would make us sense about a lot of our experiences, particularly, I mean, I used to work in the sleep lab, and one of the odd things about sleep is dreaming. We still don't really understand the purpose. Yeah. We know the effects on the body. We know that if you don't dream, you die. But we don't know the function of REM sleep. We know what happens, but we can describe it, but we can't theorize beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And just imagine some of the things you're dreaming. It seems so random, but it would certainly make sense that you're accessing from your entire brain. And perhaps that slave is starting to have a little bit of dominance during that time.
Yeah. Very interesting. So they devised an experiment that would allow them to communicate with each half of the brain in isolation. Both hemispheres of the brain can use both eyes, but they each only get half of your field of view. So with a careful combination of special glasses, monitors, and positioning, the researchers could present questions in such a way that only half of the patient's brain could see them. There remained one small problem. The right brain can't speak. Remember, there's no language center in the right temporal cortex. Fortunately, scientists are clever. They decided to leave Scrabble tiles on the table within easy reach of the left hand. What follows can be described only as freaky. One of the earliest experiments involved a young boy. Scientists flashed the word girlfriend. And once again, remember, when they're talking about the earliest experiment, we're talking within the last 50 years. This is not very long ago. One of the earliest experiments involved a young boy. Scientists flashed the word girlfriend where only his right brain could see it. His left hand spelled out the name of a girl, and the boy blushed with embarrassment. He knew the name was special, but he didn't know what question he'd been asked. Physicist Dr. Michio Kaku interviewed neuroscientists about such experiments in his book, The Future of the Mind. I have that book. I haven't read it yet. This dude's amazing. If you've seen some clips of this guy on videos on Facebook and stuff like that, he's got some amazing stuff. Dude's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
One subject in an experiment had been asked what he wanted to do after graduation. He said he wanted to be a draftsman, a very practical occupation. But when they asked his right brain, his left hand spelled out automobile racer. Draftsmen and automobile racer are wildly different occupations. One had come from the subject's rational, focused left brain, while the other came from his artistic and open right brain. The two brains had different agendas and goals for the future, but they were living in the same skull. Another patient was asked what he believed about God. His left brain spoke and said he was an atheist, but his right brain said he was a believer. An atheist and a believer coexisting in the same skull, two halves of the same brain matter, flesh and blood. So does half a person's soul go to heaven and the other to hell? Does Jesus live in only half of a person's heart?
So what did you think, John, when you first read that for the first time? Do you remember?
My first thought was, what? You know, it just completely floored me. And then it made complete and utter perfect sense. Because it speaks to the doubt that I have living inside of me. You know, I mean, I feel that difficulty, that turmoil, that trouble, that conflict in me all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And me too. I'd already gone to the point of deconstructing to the point of atheism and struggling with all the good that my faith had built into my life. It had made me a better father. It had made me a better husband. I had had great experiences with church camps and you know, praying New Year's Eve in with people. So I'd had all these amazing experiences, but I didn't believe in God anymore. And I was struggling with that. And for him to verbalize this in a scientific way was a huge release from the struggle I was having to come to a single conclusion on the dance, the energy, the tension that I was living with, and to just be able to embrace the fact that there's a big part of me that doesn't believe in God, and then there's a big part of me that absolutely uses all of my God language to express itself from time to time.
One of the most common pastoral concerns when people feel safe enough to approach a pastor, which honestly is rare, and that's a shame, about spiritual doubt is very much this sort of thing where somebody will say, well, on Monday, I felt a real strong presence of God in prayer, or, and then for the rest of the week, I just felt like God was so remote, and I felt like there certainly couldn't be such a thing. And to have a scientific understanding of why this happens may go a long way, particularly as faith-friendly psychotherapists pick up this kind of research. One of the most common forms of obsessive-compulsive disorder is called religious scrupulosity, where people are constantly doubting whether they have earned enough salvation or whether they are truly saved. And this is really particularly high in evangelical circles, underreported and probably underrepresented in the literature too. But one of the things that I'm curious to see in the next couple of years as this comes to the forefront is how this will change how that is treated with cognitive behavioral therapy.
And Jason, I think you're exactly right. I think the future of the church is to be embracive of things like this. Absolutely. Because we all struggle with this idea that you can't have any doubt. You can't ask questions. That has been so unhealthy in so many people's stories. But then you have a friend, the TV's not working, and you have a friend that says, come on, let's lay hands on the TV and pray for it. And in your mind, you're like, well, that's just as dumbass stupid as I've ever heard any thought. But then it's like, well, am I doubting God? Right. And if we can't recognize that there's a need to say, my experiences are real to me, but that statement you're saying right now about God is complete and utter nonsense, and I'm okay with that. We've right. got to recognize that, because it's unhealthy that we say, well, gosh, I doubted the person who wanted to lay hands on the television set to pray for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, what about that passage of scripture? I forget exactly where it is, but where the respondent says to Jesus, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief.
Yeah.
If that doesn't capture what we're talking about right now, I don't know what does.
Well, there's another thing that I was thinking about. So this is not exactly the same thing, but when you think of it in the light, of this right here with the doubt, the believer and the unbeliever living in the same head, what if when Paul in Romans 7, when he said, I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. If I do not, and if I do what I do not desire, I admit the law is good. In that case, it is no longer I who do it, but it is sin living in me that does it. I know that nothing good lives in me, that is in my flesh, that is in my left brain, for I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out, for I do not do the good I want to do. Instead, I keep on doing the evil I do not want to do. You know, this kind of back and forth, I think that it's very possible that this is the kind of thing. We all struggle with this kind of thing, this back and forth, I mean, sometimes it's with evil and good, sometimes it's with doubt and faith, you know, this dichotomy we all struggle with. And if we can see something scientifically, this is what science shows about the brain, that we're wired this way.
Absolutely.
And John, that is so much more healthy to understand that struggle as the natural communication pathways in our brain, and not
a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other.
Or inside. I mean, there are people that recognize the struggle, and someone tells them, well, that's Satan trying to, you know, kill you and take you to hell for eternity. Yes. And he's inside your closet to get you tonight. And that is such a unhealthy way of dealing with the natural struggle that we have in many things, this balance between logic and artistic expression in our lives.
Absolutely.
Because then you get all that guilt, because you have the power right. of Christ within you, and you didn't fight him off. What's wrong with you? That is crushing.
Yeah. It's something that atheists don't deal with. They don't deal with the crushing abuse that faith people have when it comes to dealing with this internal struggle and doubt. And the church needs to go beyond that to be a healthier place. I'm sorry, Jason.
Oh, no. I'm glad you mentioned the word abuse, because that really, if it doesn't border on and cross over the line to spiritual abuse, it's right there. One of the lines that I heard so often in my Pentecostal church growing up was, you need to have more faith. If you just had more faith, you wouldn't be struggling with this doubt, or you wouldn't.
But meanwhile, Jesus says, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could tell this mountain to move. How is there more? You get the size of a mustard seed. You don't need more.
That's precisely right. Yeah.
So let me read Mike's little outro from that. It's only a couple pages here, but there's some good stuff that talk basically about the same type of stuff that we're talking about. Many of us can relate to this paradoxical experience. Have you ever prayed fervently while simultaneously wondering if anyone was hearing that prayer? Have you offered someone comfort in faith while wondering if you believed anything that you were saying? That's a good one. Have you ever heard the words coming out of your mouth and say, do I even believe that? Man, for all its bizarreness, the phenomenon of split-brain patience gives me strange comfort. Suddenly, I don't feel so weird for identifying with both skeptical and spiritual people. There is an atheist in my brain who remains wholly incredulous about the idea of a divine being who once dwelt among us in the form of a man. Then there is a Christian in my brain who is indescribably and enduringly comforted by the idea and love of a supernatural savior. I've stopped trying to deny, starve, or otherwise do away with either of them. I let my atheist question and examine. I let him check my motives and search for ideas that can be proven. Atheist Mike contemplates ethical issues from all angles, where right and wrong emerge not from ancient texts, but from the relation between our actions and the suffering or consent of others. Christian Mike views the world through a lens of great compassion, seeing pieces of God in all his creations. My Christian side suffers with those in pain and finds reason for hope in everyone against all reason. Christian Mike believes it's never too late for redemption and that salvation is always at hand. Christian Mike wants to drop his fishing net and follow Jesus, so I let him. And atheist Mike tags along for the ride. Yeah. That is such a healthy view to me. It's holistic. It's not denying and ignoring half of who you were created to be.
It's saved by faith. This is, if I had to choose between only one, which is what I was thinking, atheism won out. It was so good to be able to say, I can keep my atheism and still grow and explore spiritually and have that conversation and have all the benefits of a spiritual life as well.
And Thad, I think that acceptance of this paradox leaves us open to deeper, more mystical experiences. I find that those who are more comfortable with the dissonance that exists between a theistic mind and an atheistic mind somehow are more open and more willing to receive these experiential, like Mike's own mystical experience he describes. He doubts it, but at the same time, he revels in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I really think if you want to have those sorts of experiences, and science says that you can have these experiences, our brains are wired for them. We go through and we just accept this paradox that exists in our brain.
Hmm.
And that experiential mystic form of faith is not a new thing when it comes to the faith traditions of Christianity or all religious traditions. I mean, it's there from the beginning. And yes, and to recognize that, which is something I didn't know growing up in, you know, Bible Belt, Kentucky. But it's been a good thing to realize. I feel more connected to the 2,000-year history of the church now than I ever did before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as an atheist.
Yeah. I mean, it existed in Judaism in Jesus' time, you know, and it existed in Christianity very, very early on, you know, and the perfect example, the most obvious example in early Christianity where it existed is when Constantine brought the empire together under Christianity. There were a certain group of people that came to be known as the Desert Fathers that brought up a monastic life, and they said, no, we can't be a part of this. We cannot watch Christianity be dragged through the mud and be made a slave to empire. And so they left society, at that time. They lived on the outskirts of society, and there's some amazing, amazing writings that come from them during that time.
And then in our own age, we've had a revival of that sort of spirituality with the likes of a Thomas Merton and a Henry Nouwen and so many others, Richard Foster within the evangelical, and Alice Willard, who would certainly not consider themselves progressive Christians.
But Richard Rohr.
Yes. Richard Rohr. Absolutely. I just finished his book on spirituality in the 12 steps. It's called Breathing Underwater. It's a brilliant book.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the I love Thomas Merton. I really identify with Thomas Merton. I had the opportunity to go out to his abbey this past summer, and I spent, Thomas Merton died of a strange freak accident in the 1960s?
Yes.
But his abbey is in Kentucky, you know, not very far from me, and they take in travelers, you know, so they have, I think, about 50 or 60 monks that live out there. You know, it's quite large, and they have a large retreat center for people that just want to come out there and partake in that monastic life along with them for just a short term. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful, amazing experience to have just the serenity of the area. And you can feel, this is my Christian side talking, my experiential side talking right now, you know, but I could feel the connection between the saints of the past in that place. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just a place. There was something seriously going on there.
And science is totally okay with everything you're talking about now. Yeah. They can put somebody under an fMRI and look at their brain when they're having these experiences and see activity associated with what we're talking about. It's amazing how well science and mystical experience, Christianity or faith traditions for all of them, they line up pretty well. What doesn't line up is the
literal six-day creation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Propositional Christianity is what I would call it. That you must believe this tenet, this tenet, this tenet. That finds no reconciliation with neuroscience.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Because those claims are not based on the same evidence that science is based on. So anyways, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that actually segues really well into our other reading, the second reading that we want to do. So talking about how God impacts your brain. So that reading, that was the one that really floored me the first time that I read it. It doesn't really talk about how God impacts your brain, but it talks about how God and doubt can live in your brain at the same time. This one does talk specifically about ways that God impacts your brain. So this is starting on page 157. There may be countless religions, sects, denominations, and ideas about God, but as far as your brain is concerned, they all fit within two categories, the angry God and the loving God. The angry God is the neurological model that forms when you understand God as primarily wrathful or angry or even just. The angry God is a God of judgment who punishes the wicked and smites the wayward. This God demands worship and submission and rewards the faithful in time. In the Bible, this understanding of God is often associated with the Old Testament, and in the landscape of Christian denominations, it finds its clearest expression among modern fundamentalist sects. This God is kind of a jerk. When you experience God as being primarily angry, this experience shows up in your brain. God becomes highly associated with the activity in the amygdala. You have more stress, and you anger more easily. It becomes difficult for you to forgive yourself or others, and you become fearful or angry toward those who don't think, look, or act like you. So the amygdala, that's what we call the reptilian brain, right?
That's correct.
So that's you got your fight or flight response in there. It's very primitive. That's your
primal emotion. Yeah.
It's not all bad, however. The angry God is great for impulse control. If you believe God might punish or smite you, it may motivate you to kick bad habits or develop healthy practices in your life. This is why you so often hear stories of people whose recovery from addiction involved dramatic conversion from fundamental fundamentalist religion. The angry God demands change, and this often leads people towards a structured life of service. Unfortunately, the angry God is ripe for exploitation. When life's meaning or one's eternal destiny is closely associated with such a god, it's easy for authoritarian systems, whether churches, governments, or even terrorist organizations, to drive people to dangerous behaviors. The angry god is exploited by political parties to turn out the vote. The angry god tells terrorists to commit acts of mass violence. The angry god then tells Christians to fear Muslims. I believe that many of the new atheist critiques of faith come down to the ways in which this ancient, powerful conception of God has often merged with political systems that prize the advancement of an ideology over the good of people. The angry God plus authoritarianism can be a toxic, dangerous combination that drives religious people to reject science, demonize outsiders, and even commit acts of violence. There's a lot in there that I really identify with from my upbringing. Mm-hmm. I mean, majorly.
So explain that, John. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, this is how I was raised. You know, that we're right. We're absolutely right. And God, the whole point of God, I mean, even though somehow God is loving, I never got that. The whole point of God is that he sees you when you're sleeping and he knows when you're awake. And if you masturbate, he's going to smite you, you know, and that's the God that I knew. That's the God that I grew up with. And that guilt that I carried from constantly fucking up, you know, I couldn't deal with that. And even though, I mean, I understand what Mike is saying here about, you see people all the time that I was deep in drugs. I was in a problem. My life was completely out of control and I found God, you know, and what they typically mean is they found a very structured, ordered system of explaining God. This is why AA is so big in fundamentalist circles. Because yes, when your life is completely out of control, then that structure is very, very attractive and helpful to you. That's why John Piper is very popular to people who have normally had a very out of control type life, and that's,
and particularly males.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So you talk a lot. I've heard you talk about tribalism comes up in the podcast. And tribalism and fear are always very close together. Mm. Right? In fact, the whole idea of tribalism is fear of the unknown, fear of the tribe over the hills, behind the trees, right?
So those things,
that's primitive. It's amygdala. It's, you know, you're literally afraid for your life if you look at them, talk to them, marry them, whatever it is. And that just doesn't work. There's a real conflict from that tribalism, fear-based thinking when you start to embrace all of humanity as your tribe, when you start to recognize people that look differently, talk differently, eat differently, sing differently from you are still people that still, you know, have wrecking balls to describe the emotions of a dating relationship. There's a conflict to try to keep that tribalism, fear-based God mentality. And that's part of why I think there's many reasons why people are leaving fundamentalist churches, but I think that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Wilber, one of the big names in spiral dynamics theory, has a book out called A Brief History of Everything, I believe it is.
I have that and I haven't read it yet. Yeah.
He talks about a shift from egocentrism to tribalism to world-centric viewpoint to a cosmos-centric viewpoint. And each time a person will expand their consciousness, they include the previous level but then transcend. And a lot of people get stuck in spiral dynamics. They get stuck at these lower levels, if you will. And oftentimes, the spiritual maturity doesn't go beyond those early levels, even though in some areas of their lives, like their professional lives, they may operate at a higher level. Their baseline level never really transcends those darker shades, that purple, that blue, that beige, even, depending on how they were raised. And they often find themselves heavily conflicted because perhaps in their professional life, they really do operate at a higher level. But in their everyday life, their family life, their social religious life, they're operating at these dark, deep bass note levels, and they can't understand what's going on. And I think Mike and the two brain theory may give some help to some of those folks.
Yeah, I love the idea of spiral dynamics, and I've been wanting to use it for language on this podcast for a while, and so I think it's in June that we're going to do a series on spiral dynamics. It should be really interesting.
Great.
Okay, back to the text. Thankfully, the angry God isn't the only God on the block. The loving God is often found in the New Testament of the Bible, in modern spiritualism, and in Eastern religions. The loving God is a gracious deity who forgives and nurtures humanity. This God delights in creation and adores humankind. The loving God affects the brain in ways that are remarkably different from the angry God. People who focus on God's love develop thicker, richer gray matter in their prefrontal cortex and anterior cingulate cortex. This development offers them better focus, concentration, compassion, and empathy. They have lower stress levels and lower blood pressure, and it's easier for them to forgive themselves and others. Over time, they even show less activity in the amygdala. Even more, people who believe that God is loving will eventually actually develop a characteristic asymmetry in the activity of their thalamus. When that happens, God's love becomes implanted in their sense of identity, and they begin to see the world as being basically safe. This not only allows the believer to experience peace, it also elevates her capacity to take risks for the sake of others. For those who know the loving God, the risk of being hurt in relationships is less important because God's love will transcend that hurt. Most religions involve an understanding of God that includes both love and anger. It's possible to have some combination of these two images of God active in your brain, just as it's possible for a person to transition from one image to the other over time. I find this neuroscience comforting. First, it helps me understand what causes faith to either go wrong and become a positive force in society. It also tells me that contrary to some claims, there's no scientific evidence that religion is bad for people. Saying religion is bad is a lot like saying eating is bad. Eating can be bad, but it depends on what you eat or how much you eat. Religion can be bad, but it depends on how you view God and how attached your faith system, your faith is to an authoritarian system. I love this passage. This part of it really, really hits a nail on the head for me in my later life also. Thad, you were talking about Steven Pinker, and we brought up the book Better Angels of Our Nature, where we talk about proofs that things are getting better, and it's not this fundamentalist idea. I mean, the fundamentalist idea of the world is going to hell, we got to wait for Jesus to come back and save us, that's the angry God, because, you know, Jesus is going to come back with a tattoo on his thigh and a sword in his mouth and kill millions of people. That's the angry God. That's right. The angry God turning Jesus into the angry God. Wow. How'd we get there?
In that passage you just read, it was talking about the feeling of being safe. I think that Maslow's hierarchy also relates to this. And just at the extremes, the lowest level of Maslow's hierarchy, you're everything's about trying to survive. And at that level, you really do have that tribal mentality, that amygdala mentality, that fear-based mentality, that give me a strong leader to protect me mentality, right? All of that makes sense when when you don't feel safe. And even somebody who can have 90%
make
of their
America
life being
great
safe.
Again.
But if so we don't live 100% of our lives safe or unsafe, right? Hopefully, majority of our life, we feel safe most of the time, most days, but there's going to be moments when we don't feel safe. And in those moments, the idea of a strong God who's going to protect me is a comfort. The idea of, but we don't want to live in that high stress, high heart rate level. We want to get to a place of feeling safe, going up in spiral dynamics, going up in Maslow, whatever you want to call it, some place that we get to be our better angels of our nature.
Well, and it's obviously where the people of the Bible, you know, Israel was living in slavery, and then they went from living in slavery to living in constant war, you know? I mean, they're living in that place at that point in their history. So obviously we've got this picture of the angry God who's going to get you.
Right.
Yeah, it's the writers at the time. Where were they writing from? And there are writers who were writing from a place of peace, and they were able to write without the fear and the destruction and the and all the good stuff that we like.
Right. Several hundred years removed from the events. I mean, looking back almost with nostalgia, perhaps. You can't have nostalgia when you are up against the wall and you have enemies on every side. So it's really a quite different experience. Once you can step out of the fundamentalist view of how the Bible came to be, you know, which is what we're going to be talking about next month with Pete Enns.
Yeah.
But you can really appreciate the humanity of the scripture much more.
Yeah. The Bible being a book written by humans about our experiences with the divine is the foundation of healthy thinking about spirituality and God, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I would agree with you. It also helps, helps people connect with the scriptures better. I'm baffled that people hold to some sort of view of divine dictation theory can ever think that there's anything in the Bible for them.
What do you mean by that, Jason? Why is it that if the Bible was divinely written, that it doesn't hold for them? Explain what you just said.
I think what I'm trying to say is, if there was no human involvement in the creation of scripture, or if God
other than the person was a typewriter,
right? Precisely. Then really the relevance was for that person, that audience, and there's no continuing relevance. So for us to pick up the scriptures other than for a history, or even depending on what your view of scripture is, a book of fairy tales, adult fairy tales, which is what somebody I know likes to call it, who would consider himself an agnostic. You know, that's about the best you could get for it. But if the Bible is written by people who were having experiences of the divine, then and only then, do these words have some relevance for us who are also having experiences of the divine and looking for ways to connect with our community in the past?
Yeah. And there's a good reason. It's all about our human experiences. There's a good reason that every religion department in a university is in a humanities college and not in a science college, because it's about human communication and expression.
Yeah.
So I want to pull out, I probably shouldn't do this because this is a can of worms, but I want to pull out something that has absolutely nothing to do with the brain. And it's just something that really, really interests me that Mike really kind of touches on. There's a lot of brain stuff that's in this book, and I think it's great. But he talks just a tiny little bit about space-time. And I'm going to read a quote from here, and I just want to get your idea. We're not going to have time to fully go into this, but I want to give just a taste of this, because I'm excited for this, because this kind of stuff I think is going to be his next book. You know, his story that he lists in this book, that's fine and dandy, you know, but this kind of stuff, this science, this melding science and spirituality together and acknowledging the paradox between them, you know, that's the stuff that's really interesting to me that comes from his head. Mm-hmm. So this bit about space-time. As humans, we experience space-time as a series of moments with some in the past, some in the future, and one special fleeting moment called now. But for God to be God, God's reference frame must include the strange, shifting perspective of Einstein's relativity. God's perspective has to encompass space-time, not as a series of moments as we see them, but as an interconnected set of coordinates that always exists. But when I think about God in this light, I am faced with something so incomprehensible that such words as being, consciousness and free will become nonsensical.
What do you like about that, John?
So everybody knows E equals MC squared. You know, we everybody knows Einstein with a little tongue sticking out and everything like that, you know, but we don't understand what his theory really meant is that time is a physical property that can change, that time changes with velocity. I mean, we see time all laid out in you know, it's completely linear, that we can't move in time at all. We can't do anything except go forward at the same velocity. Mm-hmm. And Einstein said to us, well, if you were going faster, that wouldn't be the case. And not only did Einstein say that, but we have proved this. Because that's the way that like the nuclear clocks work, and we've had tests with nuclear clocks that are, one of them is on a 747 and one of them's on the ground, and they've actually got different time on them, you know. Mm-hmm. So this is reality. This is how it works. And so this idea, I just like the idea of, you know, you see the Calvinists and the Arminists that say, oh, free will or predetermination. And when you think about this, I really like what Mike's saying about, you know, I don't know if free will even has any concept. If time is all laid out in a grid in front of God, if mm-hmm. God perceives of time in a different way, how does free will even make sense?
Right.
Now, when I read about relativity and this topic, the concept of God never comes up. So it's interesting to me, this quote and your reaction to it, because we mm-hmm. don't bring up God. This is what I mean when I say I'm right. an atheist. I'm a left brain atheist. It just never comes up. We can run all the experiments we want, and God never shows up in an experiment. But space time and relativity does show up. The GPS in your car and on your phone only works because we understand relativity, and we make the clocks in the satellites run slightly slower.
That's
because
right.
time is passing slower for them than mm-hmm. it is for us. And that's just, you know, and you just kind of accept it. It's just true, right? And people say that faith is like science. You're just accepting truths. And in a way, maybe, but science is accepting it because every single time we look at it, it's what happens. Mm-hmm. Faith is not like science. Faith, God is mysterious. The yeah. biggest thing that I see when it comes to conversations about God is, if I have a conversation with somebody and they're being dogmatic about, well, this is a fact about God. You say, well, what about this? And they say, well, here's a verse. And you say, well, here's a verse that says something else. And you go one more level. After three levels, they throw their hands up in there and they say, well, God is mysterious, right? And they're angry and they're quitting. It turns out that's where the conversation about God begins.
Yeah.
The fact that God is mysterious and not certain. Yeah. Then we can really start talking about God.
And part of this is why anybody who, to the evangelical or the fundamentalist mind, anybody who dares believe that God's relation to time leans towards an open theistic view is considered a dangerous, dangerous enemy.
Yep. Or the, what's his name? Paul Tillich. Paul Tillich's idea of God as being the ground of all being.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And I got to, I don't know what you're
guitar and feather Tillich.
Yeah, you guys say those things, and it honestly, again, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know how you talk about God and reality that way. It doesn't. Right. But if you're talking about experience, when you talk about God and experience, I can grok with you perfectly. I know what's going on. I can follow. When you start talking about God and physics, God and reality, it doesn't. It's nonsense to a scientific left brain thinking person. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about experiences, then absolutely, I think that God language or poetic language or musical language or Shakespearean language or whatever, human language, because the Bible is a book of stories written by humans that had divine experiences and are trying to explain it and share it with their friends because they love their friends and they want them to share those same experiences.
Mm-hmm. And they go knock on their friends' doors and give them tracts.
Ooh.
All right. Well, I think that opens a whole another can of worms that we can talk about in another episode. I swear I'm going to read Tillich when I grow up. All right. So it's about that time. So I want to thank you guys. This has been fantastic. This, it always goes by so quickly. There's so much good stuff. Once again, the name of the book is Finding God in the Waves by Mike McHarg. Thad, where can people find you if they want to look you up?
I have a blog on Blogspot. It's mydeconstructionblog.blogspot.com.
Okay. And I've got that up in our show notes too, if you want to take a look at that. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely. And Jason, I'd love for you to be my pastor. I wish we lived in the same town.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Jason, where can people find you?
They can find me at jasonmarmel.com, where I'm just starting a blog, and they can also find me on Facebook.
And another place that you can find both of these guys and me also, I mean, we're all part of the same book club on Facebook. It's called, it's got a big long name that I can't even remember off the top of my head. Theology Book Club for Deconstruction and Reconstruction. That's what it is. It's a secret group, and we would love for you to be involved in that. You won't be able to find it by searching on Facebook. You will need to go to my website at reclaimingchristianity.net. And there's a form you fill out there, and then I'll send you an invitation. So thank you so much about both of you guys for being here this week.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you
for having me.
Yep. See you later. So we're near the end of another episode. Just a few things I want to go over with you here, friends. The next episode is going to be the last one in this series, and it's going to be on deconstructing and community. In the book club that we were talking about, the books for April, May, and June are coming up. The book for April is The Bible Tells Me So by Pete Enns, and the book for May is Why I Left, Why I Stayed by Tony and Bart Campolo. The book for June in the book club is going to be Searching for Sunday by Rachel Held Evans. And as I said a little bit inside of the podcast, actually, we're going to diverge from the book club a little bit in that series. And we are going to talk about spiral dynamics in the month of June. So that should be really, really fun. You can be on this podcast. As I said before, just go to reclaimingchristianity.net. I would love for your voice to be a part of this community. If you would like to sponsor this podcast, check it out on patreon.com/John Weldy. You can also find us on Our Bible App, a Bible study app and community for progressive Christians. Check it out at ourbibleapp.com. You can get free books. I love giving free books to people. I've got a big, big stack of them right now that I need to be getting rid of some. So send me a request at reclaimingchristianity.net and just click on free books there. So at the end of another podcast, one last thing I want to say to you, the same thing I say every week. The most beautiful thing you can ever be is you. Do what you love. Love what you do. Thanks for listening.